Morning. So most of you know, we're spending the next couple months in Genesis looking at the Joseph story. One of the things I think I was thinking about yesterday as I do this about twice a week now, I Google for new information on Batman v Superman to see if there's like new little trailers or that sort of thing, because I like comic books and comic book movies. But I was thinking about, so then it leads to sort of meandering on other comic nerd like pages. And one of the things that I'm struck by is over the past 15 years or so, like, we've had so many comic book films, and so many of them involve a reboot to beginnings, right? So we'll have someone like Tobey Maguire play Spider-Man 3 times, then we reboot it and it goes back to the origin of Spider-Man. Or we go through different Batman films, and often it cycles back to a new beginning myth, a new beginning narrative. Same thing with the recent Superman film, the last one that came out. And I think that there's something to that. I think most of us want to know, like, from whence we come, right? If we think about, like, how we spend a lot of our time, like, what we do with our solitude or what we do when something kind of sparks something deep in us, I think a lot of times it focuses either on where we've been or where we hope we're going. Right? And sometimes we miss the present, which we ought to tend to, but I think that in some sense you don't have a present, you don't have a sense of where you are unless you know where you've been or where you're going. And it's why things like being orphaned or being adopted or other things that cut you off from sense of origins can be, I mean, it's not insurmountable, but it can be really tough if you don't have the sense of, hey, who am I? Where am I? It's why countries and nations and cultures always have kind of founding myths, right? It's really important to have this sense of foundational stories that shape who we are. And I think the Bible, one of the reasons that I think Genesis is so compelling, even to people who don't come at it with the eyes of faith. A few years ago, Bill Moyer did a special on PBS where he got Christians, Jews, Muslims, secular agnostic types all talking around a table about Genesis. And no matter where these people came from, really different perspectives on faith and life and culture, but they all found these stories so engaging. I think because they're stories that are so primal and speak to the origin of all creation, all humanity, and particularly of this chosen people, chosen for the sake of the world. And it gets sort of more particular as Genesis goes on, right? It starts with the whole creation, the whole cosmos. Then about a third of the way in, a fourth of the way in, narrows on one family and how this family develops, and then how this family becomes a nation. So there's through the origins of this couple, this Abraham and Sarah, this family, which would become the nation of Israel, the Bible's telling us that through these beginnings are the beginnings of all of our stories, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And within these beginnings is the understanding of the redemptive blessing that God weaves through amidst the curses and the tragedies and the chaos. So that being said, let's pray and we'll look at this story quickly. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. So some things I think that are worth taking a look at in this text. First, we see that there are cellmates, that Joseph is in jail. There are cellmates who have dreams, which is interesting because Joseph has been called a dreamer and dream master. And lastly, I think the interesting thing is it ends, it might not be obvious, but I think it really ends with the sound of silence, with silence for Joseph. So cellmates, dreams, and silence. Let's look at the cellmates. I think it's helpful just to sort of occasionally revisit a story like this because it's the longest sort of story in Genesis that focuses on one person and their family and in that sequence of life. Joseph, that we met three chapters ago, is a spoiled brat because his father favored him because his father had multiple wives, which happened in the Old Testament, and I don't understand how anybody isn't just driven crazy with multiple spouses, but so maybe, you know, this proof is in the pudding here. But it's obvious that he favors one spouse over the other and favors the children of that spouse. So obvious that you see Joseph says these insanely obnoxious things to his brothers. His brothers can't stand him. His dad sends Joseph out to work and tend the flock and do things like this in this really audacious coat, which clearly is sort of an in-your-face statement to the brothers that this is my favorite. They get, so the text in chapter 37 says they can't even say shalom to him, this traditional Jewish greeting. Now, they can't even say peace. They can't wish him any sense of well-being. It eventually explodes. They wind up thinking about killing Joseph. They wind up throwing him in this pit, and through a strange weaving of circumstances, Joseph winds up not dying, but winds up a slave in Egypt. But not like your everyday, like, sort of blue collar. He's not a galley slave like in Ben-Hur or something. Like, he's not having to row a heavy boat or work in brutal conditions on a pyramid or something. He winds up in the house of who's probably something like the commander-in-chief of the Egyptian military. And he winds up sort of running the whole household. But then the Potiphar, this military leader, his wife winds up trying to seduce Joseph. Joseph resists temptation and through false accusations winds up in jail. So things seem like they're maybe coming along, even though he's far from home, even though he's alone, even though he's got to deal with the family enmity and breakup of being together with his family and his brothers hating him, and whether he'll ever see his father again or be home again. Things look like they're turning up. And then all of a sudden, they quickly seem to spiral worse and worse. And he winds up in prison where he meets the cellmates that we see in this chapter. It's really interesting to note, I think, that when he meets them, he notices, the text tells us, that they're not doing well. He notices that things are not well with them, and he inquires, hey, what's going on? You guys really look down. You guys really look troubled. Now, I guess most people in an Egyptian prison look, you know, are not thrilled that they're there. But what's really interesting is I think that we see one of the things in Joseph's story, I think, and one of the reasons the story arc is so long, is that God is sort of remaking Joseph from the inside out. He's spending time, which is really hard for any of us, I think, but he's spending a lot of time in the school of suffering. Now, why I think this detail is not insignificant, think about when you're doing badly. Think about when you think that life doesn't have meaning or purpose. Think about when relationships aren't working, or family seems like a source of not just disconnection, but pain and shame, or when things don't go right at your job, or you feel like that you're never gonna get to do the thing vocationally you wanna do, and you're feeling sort of aimless, and like there's gonna be no end to those sorts of feelings. Think about that. Is your first move to look empathetically at others? How often do you, in the midst of the pain, do you think, you know what, my pain is rough, but gosh, everybody's pain is rough. And how can I, like, in the moment of weakness, look and see where other people are feeling weak? I think most of us, most days, when things aren't going well, curve in on ourselves. Luther calls this incurving, sort of one of the, almost like the root problem of the human condition. That we kind of close ourselves off to God and the world, and we kind of get caught in our own cycles. And honestly, we often do this in prosperity too, right? How often when things go well, do we forget to be gracious and thankful, and we are self-centered then too? But I think that it's especially tempting when you're struggling to think that you're the only one struggling, to think that your problems are the problems that are the most insurmountable. And that's what's so remarkable here. Joseph looks to them and says, what's going on? Like, what's your struggle? Why are you so, you know, why do you look so out of sorts? And I think that that's the beginning. When Jesus asked, what's the sum of the law? Right? He says, look, all the rules, you can boil them down to a couple of things. Love the Lord your God. And love your neighbor. Love the world. Love the people around you like you love yourself. So ultimately, I think that that's what living a godly life looks like, right? When divine energy flows through us, that's what it looks like. It looks like us being open to God and seeing him show up in places that aren't just church or Bible study. Seeing God's presence permeates the world in lots of peculiar ways, and being open to the people God's made, even when they're irritable, even when they're other people. And Joseph, it's interesting, these aren't his countrymen. They don't share his culture. They're upper crust aristocratic types. He's a former slave and now in prison. But he finds a point of connection, because I think God, again, is working on him from the inside out. And the healing in the inside turns him outside redemptively to people hurting, namely these cellmates. Which brings us to the dreams. Do I have a dream slide? Maybe I don't. I thought I did. Oh, well. Let's pretend that this slide here says dreams. The top thing says dreams. So we'll just have to, pretend. Which brings us to the dreams. So their trouble is that they're both having dreams, and that there's no interpreter. I mean, dreams were... I guess this is sort of true today, right? You buy dream interpretation books. Most of them are more psychologically or pseudo-psychologically rooted, right? So you have these dreams, and you're always trying to figure out, what does my dream mean, right? Or maybe it's just, I have this recurring dream that I'm Superman or Spider-Man or something, and then when I want to go, show my friends, all of a sudden my web shooters don't work, and I'm sure that a psychoanalyst could have a field day with that, right? But sometimes we have these recurring dreams, and we want to know, what they're telling us about ourselves, because they come from our mind, our subconscious. And in ancient Egypt, this was a whole industry, and the people that were diviners, that were masters of dreams, that when you would have a dream, you'd go to someone who purportedly was an expert in this stuff and could do something, could tell you, could reveal what the dream means. But they're down because here we are in prison, and we've got no one to do that. We've got no dream interpreter. We've got no professional sort of magician or soothsayer that can, do something with a Ouija board or, some sort of ancient Egyptian magic eight ball or something, shake it up and give me peace. Okay, this is what it means, right? No one's there. And Joseph's response is interesting. All you need is God. The dreams come from God. And so you really don't need a professional magician or soothsayer. Actually, the answers are God made you. These dreams come out of you. And he made the world and all that's in it. And actually, you don't need this mediator or this person that you think in your anxiety can pull back the curtain and make everything okay. This comes from God. Tully and Chavidian, Billy Graham's grandson, who's a pastor in Florida, wrote a book, Jesus plus nothing equals everything. Jesus plus nothing equals everything. Great book title. And I think there's something like that here, that God, that you might be here in prison, you might be stripped of your roles, you might be having these dreams that seem to portend something you don't understand, but even if you're in prison, God plus prison equals everything. Right? God minus your status and the professional soothsayers that you are accustomed to relying on when dreams are unsettling, God minus the soothsayers equals everything. That God permeates things, and if you look to him, then you can see that life means something. It makes sense. There's purpose in it. And Joseph then, we see, can interpret the dreams. And as he interprets the dreams, and the dream, it's a tough break for one of the dreams, right? One of the dreams is, hey, you're going to get exalted. Another, the cupbearer and the baker is, well, this is not going to go well for you. And they have this strange, dark image of these birds sort of eating, the bread. And it's a pretty, the carrion kind of bird imagery that things are not going to go well for you. And you're not going to get the break that the cupbearer gets. But it's interesting that the turning point in the story, the thing that got Joseph in the pit that would lead him to Potiphar's house, that would lead him into a situation of being taken advantage of or somebody attempting to take advantage of him, and then with him resisting that temptation, going to prison, it all started with dreams. It all started with some dreams that he had about his future, his destiny. Dreams that involved seemingly all of his brothers and even his mother and father bowing to him because he'd be in a position of exaltation. Now, you might have a dream like that. You can't control the dreams you have, right? St. Augustine says you can't control if a bird lands on your head, but you can stop it from building a nest there. And I mean, it's one thing to have that dream. It's another thing to repeatedly have dreams like that and say, hey, everybody, guess what? I had one of those dreams where everybody wounds up, I'm the rock star, and you guys are all like, oh my gosh, Joseph. I mean, that seems like a recipe for disaster. And maybe some of the favoritisms, we talked about a few weeks ago, some of the favoritism was sometimes we have dreams for other people that are inappropriate. Like we invest our identity stuff in them. And there's probably some of that with his father, Jacob, and him. So all these dreams, dreams about him, dreams that come from him, and seem to offer a window into how God's going to use him over the course of his life. All of those things are what got him to this place. And it's dreams at this point which give him the hope of getting out. I think that's often how God works in our lives. When things are tough, when things are confusing, when things are disorienting, oftentimes God will take themes in our life that are where we've sinned against people or we've been sinned against, past wounding. And at the right time, sometimes God will bring that thing back up to us, as he does with Joseph. And so I think that's one thing to do when we're in times of struggle and confusion and suffering. One thing we can do is we see Joseph doing that I think is really can be a redemptive sort of balm is look to other people in their suffering. The second thing is look at your own story and look at where maybe God is bringing a chance again to revisit something that caused real pain and wounding so that it can be healed from the inside out. After the dreams are given, Joseph makes this request of the cupbearer, and the language is really, really striking. He revisits his own story, right? He explains that he's there because he was falsely accused, right? He's there because he was falsely accused by his master's wife, that he's thrown in this pit, that the whole reason for him being in this really rough situation is not his own fault. And so he says to the cupbearer, remember me. Remember me when you get exalted. I think that's a pretty reasonable request, right? That's not unreasonable. Hey, remember, I've given you the key into this dream. Like, I put like a cork in the anxiety stream that's flowing out everywhere. I've noticed your pain. Like, I didn't treat you like the other. I sort of looked at you and saw your humanity and offered to help you out here. Just remember me. Remember me when you get there. And I think the most painful part of the story is what happens next. Oh, we have a dream slide now. Look at that. That's really cool. But now we'll advance to the silent side slide if we can. Awesome. I think that the most painful part of it is the silence. Here we have, at the end of the text, after it says he hanged the baker, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. The chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And the story ends, this part of the story ends, this chapter ends, with Joseph still in prison. Now, I think that is one of the toughest things to deal with. It's one thing, suffering is never easy, struggle is never easy, but it's one thing when you realize that to some degree, some of the suffering or struggle you're in is at least your own making, right? Then you can at least say, okay, I could learn something, or you can judge yourself, which even though it will make you feel worse long-term, sometimes feels better in the short-term, because when you judge yourself or other people, you at least can control a story. Again, it's generally spiritually destructive, but it's like, you know, a donut or something, right? Even though it's not nutritional long-term, it feels great when you gorge on it, right? But it's more difficult when you actually do the right stuff. When in the face of struggle, you actually are relatively faithful to what God calls us. You're open to God's presence. You're trying to love other people as best as you can. You're going the extra mile for people that you don't really have any evidence to trust. When you take all those risks and you still find yourself in jail, you still find yourself in prison, you still find yourself with your back against the wall, you still find the relationships unrestored, the job search continues, that the sense of fulfillment doesn't come, that the breakthrough with your kid or your spouse doesn't come. That's when I think it's exceedingly difficult to keep hoping. Friedrich Nietzsche says that he who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how. I first came across that quote in a book by Viktor Frankl, where he's analyzing what kind of people made it through the experience of the concentration camps in Nazi Germany as Jews. And Frankl said, we noticed after a while, it's people that came in with hope who were going to make it. Even if they didn't look like the healthiest, even if they didn't look like the most resilient, if they had hope, they were going to make it. And people that didn't have it, no matter what other resources they had, wound up not making it. So what's the hope when things don't go your way and you've tried to be faithful, you've tried to obey, you've tried to be diligent, you've tried to really love God and all those he puts in front of you, and you're still struggling? This is where there's a whole kind of school of preaching, like prosperity preaching, that's always comes up in the history of the church, but in America right now, we're just really susceptible to this. And there are preachers that say, if you just have enough faith, you'll get all the breaks. But the illustrations they have of people from their communities, it's like they always win. And I'm like, well, what about the other people? Like, statistically, sometimes somebody's got to pray, and they don't get what they prayed for. Right? So some of it, I think, is a matter. One thing to remember in these times is just perspective. Like, you know, I remember when I first got a set of six guns and a cowboy hat as a kid. I was really little. And I was like, I want to be a cowboy. I want to be a cowboy. I want to be a cowboy. No, I was really glad when I was like 17 and started the college church. They were like, well, my parents weren't like, well, we didn't put aside college money. I mean, we have a little bit for rodeo school, but that's it. I mean, you said you wanted to be a cowboy. So sometimes the cries of our heart and the nature of our prayers are not actually what we want, or they're maybe what we want at the time, but they're not what are good for us, right? And so a lot of times I'm sure Joseph thought, this is my break. Here it is, with his cupbearer. But if God had delivered him at that point, he never, as we'll see later in the story down the road, he never would have become the prince of Egypt. He never would have become Pharaoh's right-hand man. He wouldn't have saved Egypt through famine, through a bad, bad season of famine, and wouldn't have saved his family. That the suffering in the short term would have been alleviated, but he would have missed his destiny. That's not to say that we ought not to cry out to God our deepest desires and with other people. One of the great things about praying with other people is you get to know if people are honest, which takes a little while for us to pray honest prayers, right? Sometimes we do these formulaic prayers with people that we don't know because we want to seem really spiritual and pray these things that are really not on our hearts, but we want people to think that's what's on our hearts. But eventually when you get vulnerable with people and start praying, you get to know like what's on people's hearts, what they care about. And that act of vulnerability is a great thing to do. But at the same time, realizing that God knows what's best for us, and that's hard to trust at times, but God knows what's best for us. And sometimes the answer to the prayer is no, not out of spite, but out of the deepest, deepest kind of love, the deepest, deepest kind of concern, that what our desires in that one moment are not necessarily what we'll want even tomorrow. And oftentimes are not in line with the redemptive destiny that God is weaving in our lives. But first, I think we like just think maybe the cry of my heart isn't the thing I need, even though it's the thing I want. And this is where the kind of prosperity stuff really breaks down, because who's the most obedient person in the Bible? It's Jesus. Who suffers the most? Jesus. Physically and spiritually and emotionally. So there's not this link between suffering and sin necessarily. or that this is, you're suffering the most because it's the greatest season of sin in your life. Now, sometimes there are consequences for our sin, and they're not totally unrelated, but it's not like you can make a one-to-one correlation between if things are going your way or they're not, and the spiritual reality around you. Look at Jesus. Jesus, the one who is the eternal Son of the Father. At the moment, so key to his destiny, in the Garden of Gethsemane, right before he'll go through the suffering ordeal of the cross and his death for the world's redemption. What's his prayer? His prayer, this is from the Message. In Luke 22, we read it. Leaving there, he went, as he so often did, to the Mount of Olives. The disciples followed him. When they arrived at the place, he said, "Pray that you don't give in to temptation." He pulled away from them about a stone's throw, knelt down and prayed, "Father, remove this cup from me. But please, not what I want. What do you want?" At once, an angel from heaven was at his side, strengthening him. He prayed all the harder, sweat wrung from him like drops of blood poured off his face. He got up from prayer, went back to the disciples, and found them drugged by grief. That's a great trend, drugged by grief. He said, "What business do you have sleeping? Get up, pray so that you won't give in to temptation." And that's interesting. Jesus has such a window into what's going to happen. All throughout the Gospels, there are these allusions to, and there's foreshadowing that me being the anointed redemptive figure, the Messiah, it's not going to end up like you think it will. That the climax of the story isn't going to be me kicking the Romans out, me cleansing the temple with some sort of cosmic power display. It's actually going to be me broken. And Jesus seems to be so keen to that, so attuned to that. Even when his friends are saying, no. But in this moment, what does he pray? "All right, God, thank you for getting me to this moment." No, he's like, "If there's another way, I'd love it. If there's another way, that would be great." And yet, there's this submission. I think that's the key. Like, oftentimes in these moments, we sort of do one or the other. We sort of pray, "I don't want to do this," and we leave it at that. Or we sort of pray, "God, whatever you want," when really, that's not where we're at, right? I think this is, Jesus' prayer is a great model. Hey, I want to be in your will, and yet, if your will could look like this and not this, I'd love that. But at the end of the day, I realize that I trust you. Trust is brutal in any, it can be brutal in any situation, and it's where relationships can be so wounded, but that's where actually relationships also grow in vulnerability and trust. And that's the opportunity we have to grow in those situations amidst the silence. Romans 5, and again, I'm going to read from Eugene Peterson's translation, which is really great from the Message. He says, "By entering through faith into what God has always wanted to do for us, set us right with him, make us fit for him, we have it all together with God because of our Master Jesus. And that's not all. We throw open our doors to God and discover at the same moment that he has already thrown open his doors to us. We find ourselves standing where we always hoped we might stand, out in the wide open spaces of God's grace and glory, standing tall and shouting praise. There's more to come. We continue to shout our praise even when we're hemmed in with troubles, because we know how troubles can develop passionate patience in us, and how that patience in turn forgoes the tempered steel of virtue, keeping us alert for whatever God will do next." In alert expectancy such as this, we're never left feeling shortchanged. Quite the contrary, we can't round up enough containers to hold everything God generously pours into our lives through the Holy Spirit. That's what we see, like what Paul's describing there, how in suffering we can actually not just endure, but actually, we can actually profit and benefit. That's what we see enacted in Gethsemane, where Jesus praise in the midst of his darkest hour. And it's what we see, I think, it's what must sustain Joseph. The sense that God's silence isn't the sign of his absence. And now, Joseph won't fully understand how that will be. That's beyond him. But he must be able to cling to hope, because the text doesn't tell us that, well, after that, he cashed in his chips. Story ended, you know. He laid to his side and just, you know, acted like he was dead. No, he perseveres. Jesus, when he's hanging on the cross, there are one of the thieves that he's crucified in between says, today, he says, remember me. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus looks at him and says, today you'll be with me in paradise. Now, what did that mean? Because Jesus died that day. I think maybe it means that this minimal act of faith transforms the thief's circumstances. When sometimes faith involves radical acts of trust and obedience that involve us relocating our resources and changing the kinds of relationships we're in or reaching out in relationships. But sometimes faith, the real faith in the places where we need hope just to hold on, is as simple as what the thief does, looking to Jesus. And in believing Jesus that he'll remember this thief and unite the thief's story to his story, that place can be paradise. That moment where God was shut out can be the place where God floods into our life with power, with the power of his presence. And likewise, when Jesus remembers us, he also calls us to remember him. That's why we celebrate communion like many churches every week throughout the history of the church. Because when we remember Jesus, when we remember what he did for us and what he promises, we're actually remembered. That we're actually rejoined to him in new ways and to one another. It's why it's a communal practice. One of the things that the Protestant reformers did during the Reformation is they got rid of private masses. If you had enough money, if you were, you know, medieval relative, you could have a little private mass. So you didn't have to be remembered with the kind of people you didn't want to be around. The first, like, no, we're going to come and be remembered one to another, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the people you're inclined to be remembered to and the ones you're not. When we remember him, he reminds us that even though we deserve the fate of the baker, even though we deserve to sort of have, because we've been lavish and wasteful with the good gifts God's given us, we sort of deserve to be, if we're honest, to sort of be left out to dry. But Jesus takes the fate of the baker so that we can have the fate of the cupbearer. He's cast out of the king's court so that we can be brought in. And so that our face could be lifted up, not to judgment, but to forgiveness, love, and adoption as sons and daughters. And each week where we remember him and break bread together, he remembers us to him and to one another, forming us for the adventure of living in the kingdom and giving us the resources, even in the toughest of times, to know that God's seeming silence isn't his absence, and to open us up to pain and suffering in the world, that we can be agents of his healing and redemption. Amen.